Good morning and welcome to Shattering Myths, a program devoted to those of you who realize that the world's religious, political, economic, and military institutions are corrupt and counterproductive. I am Yada. Our number, if you'd like to join us over the next 2 hours, toll-free, 877-300-7645. Reuters is reporting that Putin is asking Obama to join him in talks regarding Syria. Imagine that. Here is the crucible for World War III. Here is the cauldron from which already 1 million and soon to be 10 million Muslims are migrating away from the hellish conditions perpetrated by Muslim upon Muslim into Europe, creating a humanitarian crisis of greater proportions than the world has ever seen. A dependency class, by the way, that in the midst of all of this and in the most brutal, vicious war man has witnessed in at least half a century, that Putin is saying to Obama, you know, we ought to talk about this. You know, stop sending your head of your State Department just to badmouth me and to slander me and the like. Let's sit down and talk this through. Because what you're doing there is insane. And, you know, maybe there's a chance, since you're a lame duck president, that you can be convinced that what you're doing is insane. You are bombing the Islamic State into the most popular religious organization in the world. You're enhancing them by attacking them. And who are you fighting against? You say that you're opposed to Assad, oh, abominator. But Assad is vastly better as a dictator than any of the alternatives that are going to take control of Syria when he's gone. It's just like Saddam Hussein. He's vastly superior for his own people and for the world than is the Shiite government that began to blast away using American weapons at the Sunnis, civilizations, the population of civilians in Iraq to create this Sunni Shia war. So if you are opposed to Assad, are you realizing that if he falls, you're going to have a situation that's far worse than what we found in Libya, and that Libya is as bad as any place on earth, that it is a country dissected by gangs of jihadists, and that that's what Syria will be in the wake of Assad? How can that be good? How can you believe that there is a mythical group of people out there that are democratic and freedom-loving and non-religious that are going to fight to the death against both Shia and Sunni Islamic militias and against the Syrian military collectively, and that they're going to garner enough support that they're going to be able to take control of that country? And so, rather than start World War III, rather than exacerbate the world's greatest conflict, why don't we talk about what the appropriate solution is? Let's not make the mistake of Libya. Let's not make the mistake of Iraq again. Aren't those fresh on our mind? Let's not make the mistake of Afghanistan. Let's not make the mistake of Vietnam all over again. Let's learn from our past and learn from the present, and let's plot a different, more sane course. Oh, that's what he would like to talk about. I expect the abominator to turn him down. At least 4 people have died, we read, when a bomb exploded at a refugee camp in northeastern Nigeria. The refugee camp was for people who had fled their homes because of the Boko Haram Islamist group. So here is another example of Muslims creating a terrorist regime, kidnapping and raping little girls, decapitating men and boys, robbing communities of their possessions, burning them to the ground, instilling fear through terror in the name of Islam, causing hundreds of thousands of people to flee, and then going into the camps where they have fled your terrorist doctrine and perpetrating acts of terrorism there so that there's no safe haven for anyone against Islam. Emergency services told the AFP news agency that the blast was caused by an improvised explosive device. Why? Because that's what Muslims do. They don't manufacture the weapons of war. They cannibalize the weapons of war to make their own improvised killing devices. It occurred at a camp for displaced persons on the outskirts of the Yola state. Yola has been seen as a relatively safe place for those fleeing the violence perpetrated by Boko Haram, the Islamic group named that books and Western education are against Islam. There were reportedly more than 1,000 children in the camp before these bombs were detonated. 2 million people have been forced from their homes by the Boko Haram Islamic jihadists. 2 million people. How many millions have been forced from their home in Libya? How many millions in Syria? How many millions in Iraq? How many millions in Turkey? How many millions in Yemen? How many millions in Somalia? How many millions in the Sudan? How many millions in Egypt? What do these places have in common? Islam. We're not talking about a few hundred thousand. Let's just take them in and show what great humanitarians we are. We're talking about tens of millions, perhaps hundreds of millions, throughout Africa, Northern Africa, Western Africa, Eastern Africa, throughout the Middle East, from west to east, from north to south, all living in the terror imposed by the religion founded on terror, by a prophet who said, "I have become victorious with terror." And now Islam is even attacking the refugees that it has displaced by the imposition of terror. And while 2 million people have been displaced in Nigeria, and collectively that many number again in Chad and the other Islamic nations south of Libya, where the weapons provided by the United States and Qatar to arm the Islamic jihadists to overthrow Muammar Gaddafi have now been spread and are being deployed against the civilian populations, you have millions more, that just by the hand of Boko Haram, the fundamentalist Islamic group which has declared its loyalty now to the Islamic State, 17,000 people have been murdered. A number very similar to that have been enslaved and are gang raped. A number that is 20, 30, 40 times that have had their homes burned to the ground, their possessions stolen, all in the name of Allah and Islam. According to Amnesty International, the 17,000 people killed in the conflict are a small number compared to those who have been robbed, those who have been mutilated, those whose possessions have been taken from them. Although the militants have been forced out of some of the territory they have seized, they are still active and there has been an upsurge in suicide bombings, the signature act of Islam, since May. Changing continents for a moment, the court in India's Mumbai city has found 12 men guilty for their roles in a 2006 bombing of commuter trains. The 12 men were accused of waging war and of conspiracy to murder. The serial bombings on July 11, 2006, killed 189 people and mutilated the bodies of 800 more. The perpetrators, they were Islamic militants. They were backed by the government of Pakistan. Sentencing is expected to be pronounced here shortly. But once again, you have Islam acting Islamic. CNN, Dateline is Europe. Europe is in the midst of an unprecedented human migration, fleeing war, fearing for their life, and dreaming of a better life from the poverty and upheaval of their unstable nations. Hundreds of thousands are flocking to Europe's shores. It's actually millions. The migrants and refugees risk their lives in rickety boats and in cramped truck containers, only to be greeted by governments that can't agree on how or if to welcome them. What was the cause of the war that they're fleeing? Why are they fearing for their life? Why are they dreaming of a better life? Why are they leaving poverty and upheaval? Why are their nations unstable? Why? What do their nations have in common? Here is a CNN map of the world. It speaks of where they're fleeing from. Syria. At least 4 million have fled the war. Actually, the United Nations says 8 million. Afghanistan. It says the second largest producer of asylum seekers. Iraq. More than 3 million are fleeing the Islamic State. Gee, what does Afghanistan, Syria, and Iraq have in common? And why didn't they add Libya, which is where this migration began? What do those countries have in common? Why are they impoverished? Why is there war? Why do they fear for their lives? Well, let's see if we can get this right. The cause of the instability that they were suffering from, the cause of the poverty that they were suffering from, the cause of the mass murders that were being perpetrated on them, the cause of the terror that they were enduring. The cause of all of these things was indisputably Islam. And yet, all of these millions of Muslim migrants are taking the very cause of the terror, the mass murders, the instability, and the poverty with them. And Europe is accepting them. Why would anyone in their right mind accept, bring into their home poverty, instability, lawlessness, mass murdering, terrorizing individuals? Why would you do that? By the millions. Well, that is indeed what is happening. This story is related. It says two men standing in yellow jumpsuits, staring towards the camera with a chilling message posted below their portraits. For sale. The images tucked away in the final pages of the latest edition of the Islamic State online magazine, The Bek. They're part of a troubling new claim. The terrorist group, the Islamic State, says that it's holding two more foreign nationals hostage. One page reads, Norwegian prisoner for sale. The next says, Chinese prisoner for sale. These pages show images of the men from several angles and ask for an undisclosed ransom to pay for their release and transfer. The men appear to be wearing tags with their names and identification numbers. It's an ominous warning beneath the Iraqi phone number at the bottom of each page. This is a limited time offer. Hello, Larry, my friend. I haven't heard from you on this program in a while. It's always good to see your name and to hear your voice. How are you?
I'm okay. I've just been hiding out. How was your Tarua?
Wonderful. In fact, I spent the last 2 hours of Tarua, Tarua-ing. Tarua means to shout out a warning and to signal a beneficial message. And so I spent the last 2 hours on the Louis Free radio show. It's called Brain Food from the Heartland, with a chance to speak to those who are, you know, relatively unfamiliar with the Yahweh's message.
Yeah, which would be basically everybody.
yes, it's true. It's 999,999 out of every 1 million would fall into that category. Those who do not know Yahweh.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I put together a pretty good note on this.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, not one aspect of it had anything to do with the new year.
No, that's what's interesting. As a matter of fact, when Louis Free, who is ethnically Jewish, not religiously Jewish, in fact, he's reading Questioning Paul now, when he came on the show, he said, you know, happy Rosh Hashanah. He says, all of my Jewish friends are condemning me for working on Rosh Hashanah. And I said, well, it's a marvelous opportunity to point out two things. The vast preponderance of ethnic Jews, actually Yahudim, means related to Yah, are not religious. So this notion that Judaism and being Jewish are synonymous is false. The vast preponderance of ethnic Jews are agnostics. They're not into Rabbinic Judaism. And this notion that Rabbinic Judaism is Torah observant is disproven by Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah is Babylonian, means head of the year. And Yahweh announced that this day was Teruah. So the Torah says Teruah, and Rabbinic Judaism says Rosh Hashanah. I guess the Rabbinic Judaism is not Torah observant, huh?
No, not at all. I mean, you know, if it was to come down to, you know, a new year,
mm-hmm.
then we would have to say that Yahweh's words fall very short, because he never mentions the new year. He does mention a harvest
right
at the end of the season.
Right, of summer fruit. Mm-hmm. And he says that it's the first day of the seventh month. How can the first day of the seventh month be the start of the year?
Well, I've always thought that, too. I mean, I don't know. Maybe we could dig somebody up that could tell us. I've never heard such a thing, you know.
Well, he does not have a New Year's Day celebration. A New Year's Day celebration is based upon Janus, the Roman god of doorways. And it's a counterfeit for Passover, which is the doorway to life. The Yahweh begins the first day of the year, not celebrating the day, just observing the fact that it's the first day of a new year. And he does so by telling us to look at the renewal of the light on the moon's surface when barley is Abib. And if, Larry, if you could stay with us over the commercial break, let's talk about why he described it that way. Welcome back to Shattering Mess. The reason we're going to talk about this is not only because we can learn something from it, and that's the purpose of this day, but it's also to destroy the myth that to be Jewish, you are Torah observant, and the myth that if you're Torah observant, you must be Jewish. Neither of those are true. And the fact that Rabbinic Judaism and religious Jews are celebrating Rosh Hashanah today as opposed to Yom Teruah is a case in point. So let's turn to what Yahweh says at the beginning of the year. What do you think, Larry? What do you find, Yahweh, how does he define the first month of the year? What does he call it?
Well, it's called Abib. It's when the green kernel there in the grain,
mm-hmm, barley,
is just forming. And that's it. That's that's the first of the year.
Right. Yeah, he defines it during the Exodus, right before the Exodus. He establishes the time for the first Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim. And he says that this month begins when there is a bloom, a blue flower that is on the flax, and where the barley is Abib, which means that the kernel of the first grain of the year is a growing, still green, still receptive, still, and that's really important, growing and receptive. And that defines the beginning of the year. Well, that takes place within 2 weeks, one way or the other, of the spring equinox. So if that's the first day of the first month of the year, which he says, by the way, don't celebrate. It's the 14th day that we celebrate, 14th, 15th, and 16th day of that month that we celebrate. How in the world can the seventh month be the head of the year, Rosh Hashanah?
Well, it could be if you decided that the Temple of Marduk and the training that you received in Babylon was more important than that of Yahweh's words. And that's the only way I can see it.
Yeah. So you're not being Torah observant, you're being Talmud observant. And that would break a lot of myths, doesn't it? Because when you tell people you're Torah observant, the first thing that most ignorant people will assume is that you're Jewish, right?
Right.
All right. Are you Jewish?
No. I think.
Are you Torah observant?
Yes, I am.
Yeah.
Elise points out that she's Jewish and she's on with Teruah. There are those few strange, you know, Yehudim. They're actually Yehudim at this point, you know.
Right.
So there's a couple of them out there, you know, and they just follow the Torah.
It's pretty hard to go astray if you follow the Creator God's directions. If He provided guidance, which He did in His Torah, the likelihood of the author of life and the creator of the universe misleading his creation, I would say, is remotely improbable. It's just not the case.
No,
why would he create? Yeah, why? Can you imagine the creator God of the universe saying, I'm going to create a universe, big universe, and I'm going to conceive life, and then I'm going to reveal myself to them, and then I'm going to give them a book called Guidance, the Torah, and the purpose of that book is to mislead them, to enslave them.
That would be a religious deity, an insane religious deity.
Right.
His words couldn't be counted on. What it actually says in Korah is very simple. Korah misnamed Leviticus today. I have no idea what Leviticus means. But it says in the seventh month, on the first of the renewed moon, there exists for you a Shabbaton.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a memorial sign. And a mental reminder of an inheritance.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
What are we inheriting?
Well, the entire universe. Because you get that. It's called Teruah, and it's a set-apart invitation to be called out and meet. Now, it does not say anything there about a happy birthday party or New Year's Day party or a day to celebrate your religiousness in a new year. It says it's a mental reminder there for an inheritance rite, and that inheritance comes by way of the first four Moed Mikra that have all been fulfilled in the spring.
Don't you find it interesting, though, Larry, that Rabbinic Judaism would place their Babylonian fraud right on top of one of Yahweh's invitations to meet, and they put the Babylonian fraud of Rosh Hashanah on the same day, at the same time that Yahweh is encouraging us to do what we're doing, to share His testimony.
It's called a counterfeit. It's called advancing a lie.
Okay, what about Christianity with them putting their Easter right on top of Passover?
And that's out of Babylon, too.
Right. So
the end, we got Yahu Kanan telling us in the end there, come out of Babylon.
Right.
You know, Babylon's, he wrote that in, what, 69 CE or thereabouts.
Right. And actually, it's not him speaking.
No, I understand.
He's recording. He is recording the testimony. It's like Moshe recording Yahweh's testimony throughout Bereshith, Genesis, and Shemot, the names, Exodus, and Kara, invitations to be called out and meet, Leviticus, and the Badim, which is words, Deuteronomy. I even hate to say Deuteronomy. It just gives me the creeps.
What the hell does that mean, anyway?
A second law. Second law.
a second law. Well, there second wasn't law. A first law ever established because there wasn't a law.
So how could you have a second one? That's why it gives me the creeps when I say it. But Dabarim, which means words, you know, it's in the Revelation. It's not the revelation of John, as the Christians would have you see it. It is Yahusha and other envoys on behalf of Yahweh speaking to and enlightening Yahuchanan. So he's simply writing down what they had to say. Come out of Babylon, my people, is in Yahusha's voice. And you know why he's talking to them about coming out of Babylon? Because Babel represents confusion. It means in Baal, which means with the Lord, and the Lord is Satan, and it is the basis of the religion of Christianity. That's where they get their Easter, where they get their Sunday worship, where they get their Trinity, where they get their Lord. That's where they get their Sunday worship. All of it's from Babylon.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I'm no stranger to this fact. I what's kind of amazing to me is that I can throw this up, okay? The same, I can clearly show that the first of the year is when it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I can do that with somebody who has, you know, they're basically non-religious, but they consider themselves to follow rabbis, and they do.
Right.
Because they're out there saying Rosh Hashanah.
Right. So you can quote the Torah and say this is the beginning of the year. It's Abib, and you can define Abib and define the time.
They actually wrote, of course, in their Tanakh, they actually wrote Rosh Hashanah. Astounding. It's astounding.
Yes.
I guess it doesn't matter that it's Teruah. It doesn't matter that it's a counterfeit. It doesn't matter it's from Babylon.
No. You know, the first edition of the King James, in fact, the King James until just recently, you know, the last 50 years or so, had Yahusha celebrating Easter with his disciples.
Yeah, it's astounding. Of course, they didn't have Yahusha, so they had Hesus doing it.
Of course.
And of course, Hesus is perfect for that because he's just out of the Druid cult.
Right.
So the Druid cult was advancing more sun worship, which is why, upon his return, Yahweh says, you know, they've been burned and blinded by the sun.
Right.
And of course, he's returning at twilight. So we're not talking about the physical sun there. We're talking about Halal ben Shikar,
right,
the arrogant son of the morning rising sun.
Right, sun the one that Paul, Saul, saw on the way to the road to Damascus.
Yeah.
Same exact one.
Exactly.
Yeah. In fact, today I had the opportunity to speak of some of the most egregious myths in Christianity. And you have to ask a Christian, why don't you believe Yahusha? First of all, you don't know his name, but if you did know his name, why don't you trust what he had to say? You know, what did he have to say about the Torah in the Sermon on the Mount?
That's where you start. That's you enter the gate, you know.
Right. And through the narrow gate. What is the narrow doorway? The narrow doorway.
Pesach,
Passover. Hey, you know what with the Roman Catholic replacement, you know, the Jews' head of the year is a counterfeit for Teruah. But the Roman Catholics have a head of the year replacement for Yahweh's start of the year. They call it January 1st. Janus is the
two-headed monster god.
Right? Yeah, he is the god of comings and goings, of doorways. And so is it not also a counterfeit for the doorway that is Passover?
Of course, and if you remove that J, what do you have?
The south side of a critter-headed north is what you have. Wow.
Yeah. So Nori's all over it, isn't it? It's just amazing. I think what blows me away is that, you know, people go out here and they say, well, I just do this or I just do that. They verify nothing.
Right.
There are so many signposts along the way. I think the way you wrote it was that there's like this finger pointing this way, and the next turn there's a finger pointing that way. And that's right, because they're all tied in, whether it's Babel, Bible,
right.
Babylon, or whether it's Sheol, question him, and Sheol, the king that they decided to follow as opposed, he was like the archetype for Paulos.
For Paul, yeah. In fact, Paulo's telling people to submit to their government is identical to what the people of Israel chose with King Saul.
Good point.
Yeah, the King Saul and the apostle, the wannabe apostle Paul, same exact individual, same ego, same corruption, same lies, same consequence. That's why King Saul was a prototype for Paul, the founder of the Christian religion. And the sightings of the number of times that Yahweh mentions Shaul, Paul by name, condemning him as the plague of death, it's scores of times.
So
throughout the Torah prophets and such.
Shaul?
Yes.
Throughout
the Psalms.
Yeah, it's astounding. The plague of death. It's one of the more advanced prophecies written down.
Yeah, you would think that if a religion is going to be so popular that it becomes the largest religion in human history, and that it's based on counterfeiting the truth, it's a lie piled on top of the truth, that Yahweh would have a lot to say about it, and that it would be very critical. And indeed, he does. We could talk all day, Larry, as to why Christianity is wrong and destroy the myth of the religion, the Pauline doctrine. But there's something that is, and that's a huge part of Teruah. But there's something even more important on Teruah. You know, recognizing what isn't true is a good start, but it doesn't get you home. You need to follow and embrace and accept that which is true. And the only thing that really matters that's true is the covenant. So are there any terms and conditions that we ought to be mindful on this day regarding this covenant? For example.
Yeah. There sure are. Go ahead.
First of all, this covenant, how many of them are there according to Yahweh?
There's one covenant.
Only one. Okay. Only one covenant. So there can't be a renewed covenant.
No, it's renewed on Kippurim upon the return. There, it shows right there in Zechariah, you are my children, and they will say Yahweh is our mighty one. As simple as that.
Yes, and it's pronounced in Jeremiah 31, where he says that the covenant will be renewed with Yisrael and with Yahudah, not with a Goyim church, and that upon the renewal of the covenant, that he's going to write his Torah inside of his children. Do you think there's anybody alive today that has Yahweh's personal writing of the Torah inside of them?
No, they wouldn't have to study it, would they?
No, they wouldn't. You and I love the Torah. We spend a lot of time observing it, but I have to look outside of myself to read the Torah. I'm looking forward to the time that I've got a perfect copy of it inside of me. So we don't have that.
Astounding idea, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
One thing I would point out, even though it's, Yahweh spends a great deal of time exposing corruption, so it does count. You know, King Sheol was in a constant fight with the House of Dode. They had serious battles in all of Israel's history.
Correct.
And I think as it is then, in the beginning, it will be in the end.
Yes.
I really do. I think that
And by the way, who prevails?
Well, it's Dode and it's Yahweh. Yeah.
Who's do we have a book of King Sheol that is inspired King Saul, that's inspired and put as part of the Torah prophets and Psalms? I don't think so.
No,
we don't. But do we have copious amounts of songs supplied and inspired by Yahweh from Dode in the Torah prophets and Psalms? So whose side do you? So in that battle between King Saul and King Dode, whose side do you think Yahweh was on?
Well, he's on Dode's side, and it's actually Sheol, just like Sheol.
Yeah, it is. Exactly.
And they share the same root with Sheol.
Yeah, and so when God returns, you know, if he in fact picked Shaul, Paul, to be his lone spokesperson for the entire Gentile world, for the entire world, when he returns, certainly he's going to establish his kingdom based upon the apostle Paul, right? But that's not what he says, is it?
No, he says he's going to establish it based on the House of Dode. You know, that's what he said he's going to do, and that's what will happen. I just, you know, we sit here and we, you know, you put this information out day after day after day after day after bloody day, and it falls on so many deaf ears. And these are people who pretend to give a damn what the Creator said. Why do you think they're so blind and deaf? And those were the words Yahusha used about them, too.
Yes. It's amazing that they are, but it's also amazing what happens to an individual when they're exposed to the truth, particularly if they're open-minded. Elise is on the line, someone you know, Larry, and you've seen her through this process of coming to realize that she had been lied to by rabbinic Judaism and now embraces the truth of Yahweh. Hello, Elise, how are you?
I'm doing very well, and you?
Fine, thank you. So you are a member of Unpopular Truth, which is the Larry's Facebook site that strives to create a forum for those who shamar, who observe, and who love the Torah.
Yes, it's Unpopular Truth is a fantastic place to not just share, but also to make connections that you wouldn't otherwise have bouncing off each other.
Right.
But I wanted to call in and say what it's like, really like.
Okay. And we're going to need you to stay on, Elise.
Jack.
Yeah, Elise, could you stay on the line? Stay on the line with us because we've got the music. This is the top of the hour. We're going to have news and a commercial break. But we want to hear from you, and we will do so as soon as we start the segment at the top of the hour. Please stay with us.